We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Thank you for filling in comment cards and question cards and keeping questions going and letting me hear or read where your thinking's at. It's very helpful to me. Let me pick up some of those cards, some of those questions that were raised last time, and encourage you, even on the course on the way through the lecture today, to jot down the questions you have or the comments as we're going, because at the end we usually don't have much more time except for to get out and to drop them in the box on the way out. The box, not the rubbish bin. Now, last time people have raised the question about the Old Testament, whether life was meaningless then because the resurrection hadn't taken place and so there was no meaning beyond the grave. In part, of course, that's true, although in part what's being argued here is it's not true, that God actually gives life to meaning to life itself. It's just that it's not fully meaningful. Well, we're going to deal with that more today, and it certainly is after the resurrection that all the jigsaw pieces fall into place, and prior to the resurrection that hasn't taken place. But there is some meaning in the world. That's the problem. If the world was meaningless and looked completely meaningless, we wouldn't have quite the problem we've got, because the problem is it looks meaningful, and yet for some people it's meaningless. Can Christians live a happy life ignorant of life under the sun? Yes, they can. They frequently do. That is, they do not see how meaningless the world is without God. Their non-Christian friends often see how meaningless it is, but the Christian doesn't see it, just naively, blindly goes along enjoying the good things of this life. And there's a great danger in that. There's a great danger that they get sidetracked into the world and the world's value systems, because they think it's all just as much fun not being a Christian as being a Christian, and they don't understand meaninglessness. It's also a great deception too for those who have been Christianized. Because those of us who have been Christianized and have taken on the fact that the world has a meaning and is meaningful and purposeful and you can lead a meaningful, purposeful life, who have taken on those Christianized values, they have dispensed with God and haven't realized that with dispensing with God they also dispensed with the values. And so they go on living a Christianized ethic, but without any reason or rationale behind that ethic. They may as well go on living a totally atheistic ethic of meaninglessness and futility and stupidity. And so Ecclesiastes is a very important book, because to the secularist it calls upon them to be genuine, to really face up to the full implications of their position in the meaninglessness of life. And to the Christian it warns us of what the full consequence of the alternative is, so that we won't get sidetracked by it. I raised the meaninglessness of the space program last week and suggested that I'm sure that there was some good side benefit came from it and someone could tell me about it, and someone very kindly has. Water purifying tablets came from that, and so we've been able to help the third world with water purification. Mind you, I guarantee, and we'll bring it out in the next week or two, that most of the water purifying tablets go to help the health workers rather than the poor. But it will happen, and it is also extraordinary, isn't it? In order to purify the water of the people living in the third world under very difficult circumstances, we decided to send a man to the moon, and when we got him there, we decided to purify waters for the world. It's part of the absurdity of the way in which most of our discoveries are made because of war. In the process of killing people, we find out how to save some. Is Solomon the author of Ecclesiastes, several people ask? Well, the book takes the role of Solomon. The author takes the role of the wisest, richest son of David, that was Solomon. But it's not said specifically that it was Solomon that was writing it, or it's not in the sure, you're not sure whether that's a literary device he is using or whether it is Solomon writing. And therefore you need to be wary about drawing conclusions from that in terms of the life of Solomon. Furthermore, drawing conclusions from Ecclesiastes is difficult anyway. I mean, snippets of verses come forward and ideas are put forward which later verses tell you are completely wrong, because you're getting here the philosophy of life under the sun as well as the philosophy of life under heaven, and the two get mixed in together. And there are some very strange verses. Ecclesiastes has a verse, do not be right overmuch, do not be overright, overly righteous. That's a very strange verse, given the rest of the Bible, which encourages us to be as righteous as we can, to hunger and thirst after it.
And you've got to weigh up what that means in the context of chapter 7 where it comes. Well, there's a lovely verse that the capitalists love. Socialists hate it. It's a favourite memory verse of capitalists, where it says in chapter 10 that the fool's heart inclines to the left. You've got to be wary of how you apply the verses of Ecclesiastes. It's not like other parts of the Bible where you can learn a memory verse and it will be... It's not even like the book of Proverbs, where the book of Proverbs will give you a memory verse that is true and right. Ecclesiastes, as a piece of literature, is not like that. And so we need to be wary in the conclusions we draw. And I hope in our working through the studies together, you'll see some method of finding the conclusions for our life. Several people have written little poems for me to help me out in understanding and different ways, and they've been very entertaining, and I appreciated them enormously, and thank you for them. Someone wrote to me about a music group called The Smiths on the assumption that I wouldn't know who they were. They were completely right. I've never heard of them, but now I have. So you, of course, all know it, seeing that you sit up late watching MTV night after night, and so you know about The Smiths. Well, they have a song, and I understand it's a non-Christian group, and never having heard this song, you'll excuse me if I read it out with not the right kind of rhythm and pattern or volume or stupid look on my face. But they have a song which goes like this, and here is the non-Christian echoing Ecclesiastes. It's entitled, Heaven Knows I'm Miserable. I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable now. I was looking for a job, then I found a job, and heaven knows I'm miserable now. In my life, why do I give valuable time to people who don't care if I live or die? Two lovers entwined pass me by, and heaven knows I'm miserable now. Oh, you've been in the house too long, she said, and I naturally fled. In my life, why do I smile at people who I'd much rather kick in the eye? Something nice and generous about non-Christian philosophies of life, isn't there? It really grasps hold of the stupidity of it all, and the bewilderment of it all, and the lostness of it all. It can be repeated in many, many forms. Someone wrote one little poem for me, a little line, a little proverb, which I thought was delightful. I wish my life was like a lecture. They give out notes, so you don't have to attend. Yeah, it's got a great appeal to me. And I thank you. I will use it. And then there are questions. Does Ecclesiastes make any comment relevant to the atheist who finds meaning to life in serving other people? Well, yes, it does. Many comments. In fact, it's just that kind of person the book is written to. These are the best kinds of atheistic neighbours to have, the ones who want to serve people. Anyone who wants to be an atheist and who wants to serve people, I'm happy for you to live next door to me, especially if you want to serve me. They are the kinds of people that the society... It's very good. I'd much prefer them than the atheist who wants to destroy people, kill people, hijack people, murder... I mean, they're horrible atheists. The ones who want to serve people are the ones that we want to have in our society. But under the sun, under atheism... The meaning they are finding in serving people is meaningless. There actually is no point in serving people if you're an atheist. None whatsoever. You may find meaning there, but by finding, you're actually misusing the word. You're not finding it there. You're making it up there. You're determining that you want to do that. But you will not find it out there because there is no objective value base, because everything is meaningless. You are an accident and the people you are serving are accidents. And there's no difference between serving them or killing them, really, because that's just another accident. It's completely meaningless. You choose to serve them. Well, that's great news and I'm very glad, and please come and live next door to me. But you're not finding a value called service of people. You're making up a value. And somebody could equally make up, just as rationally, just as reasonably, make up another value calling ripping them off. And that would be just as valid an expression of the accidental nature of the universe as serving people. Now that is what Ecclesiastes is dealing with. Certainly people keep finding values because actually the values are out there. But as soon as you start saying the values are out there, you've got a problem. Because where do the values reside in an accidental universe? That's the problem. I heard the hijack described on the radio this morning as evil. It's on the ABC. extraordinary expression. Because if there is no God, there is no good and bad. If there is no good and bad, there is no evil. If there is no evil, what the hijackers did was sport. It was an entertaining exercise that lasted a little too long. It was like a cricket game drawn out. It was just another form of activity of humans. To say that it's evil requires you to believe in some forms of absolutes. To believe in some forms of absolutes is very difficult if you're an accidentalist. You see the problem? To say it was just a game of sport is little comfort to the families of the two men who were killed. Solomon Grundy. Having come to parenthood, I enjoy the privilege now of reading and remembering the children's poems, the nursery rhymes, that I never read or understood when my parents read them to me. I have inflicted them upon my children to make sure they don't understand them, so that when they become adults, they too can enjoy them. Solomon Grundy. Born on Monday, christened on Tuesday, married on Wednesday, took ill on Thursday, worse on Friday, died on Saturday, buried on Sunday. And that is the end of Solomon Grundy. You'll notice, John, that he took ill the day after he married. Just draw your attention to that. Time is a very funny thing, and what happens in time is a funny thing. For centuries, people have puzzled over time, and people, especially in this century, have entered into fairly serious philosophical, mathematical, physical analysis of what time is and what it's not. But all ponder over the changing tides and of fashion and of life as your time goes on. All have noticed, I presume you have already, the increasing speed of every year. As each year occupies a smaller percentage of your consciousness, so the year goes faster and faster. Christmas comes around quicker and quicker. Exams come around quicker and quicker each year. And for me, it's Christmas and Easter. They come around quicker and quicker. And it seems that life is permanently wrapping up presents now, because it's always just happening or just about to happen. It's going so fast these days. And we all have a model, unconsciously, sometimes consciously, we adopt a model of what happens in time, a model like Solomon Grundy. I mean, last week we saw the model of a cyclical pattern, that everything is repeating itself over and over again. It's not going anywhere, it's just going round and round. That can be very sophisticated, like the Stoics, who believed that the whole world was in a 5,000-year cycle, so that in 5,000 years from now, you'll be sitting there and I'll be standing here giving it all again. But it can be just the laid-back. A shopkeeper down in Hurstville told me she was ruminating on life as I bought my pound of whatever it was I was buying from her. And she said to me, well, life's like that. You're born, you grow up, you procreate, you die, your children, they grow up, they procreate, they die, their children grow up, procreate. That's what life's about. It's just a cycle of birth and procreation and death, and there's nothing more to it than that. Others see that the whole scheme, though, is going somewhere. The historical determinism of a Hegel, which filters through to Marxism, although it's a great point of debate as to whether he was a full-blown determinist or not, the whole idea of time is that it's like a yo-yo. That it keeps, the yo-yo keeps going down and up and down and up and down and up, but each time it goes down a less distance and comes up until ultimately it's grabbed hold in the hand. And so the yo-yo has progressed from down the bottom to the top, but it's done so by going up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. Right? Now that's what time is like, with the great thesis and antithesis and synthesis, and it keeps moving forward, not in a steady line, but in a jerking back and forward, but it's going somewhere, so that we are going to reach the great state in the future somewhere. Others, though, see it's all meandering mindlessly and nowhere. It's just wandering without any rhyme or reason. The existentialist historians, which is almost a contradiction in terms, see it like that. For example, there's a big, heavy history of Europe since the French Revolution, produced by a man called H.A.L. Fisher some years ago now. And in his introduction, he writes, "One intellectual excitement has, however, been denied me. Men wiser and more learned than I have discerned in history a plot, a rhythm, a predetermined pattern. These harmonies are concealed from me. I can only see one emergency following upon another, as wave follows upon wave. So there's no rhyme, there's no reason, it's not going from A to Z, it's just happening. All these happenings just keep happening, and there's no purpose, there's no direction, it's just happenings, that's all that's happening. It's just like a wave upon wave, which of course shows that he's a historian, not a geomorphologist, because they know that waves have patterns, but we leave aside that little problem for his writing. The idea is that it's all... Now, of course, would you read a book that says that's what history's like? Well, you'd be a fool to, wouldn't you? Because what do you expect to see? Every page will just be another random event. Without any line and connection, it would be just like reading an encyclopedia, although even they're organised alphabetically. It would be just a matter of collection of information. John Smith was born. Rika so-and-so died. Someone else shot somebody. I mean, just random facts have happened. There's no... And of course, Mr. Fisher's book is not a meandering nothingness. It follows a pattern. Then there are those who will see it as a direct development. The optimistic humanists are along this line, and we get caught up with it. The 19th century was very big on this. Evolution, development, progress are all words which give us the feel of starting from something crude and unworthy and going upwards to something that's marvellous and wonderful. There's that sense that none of those words actually mean that. You can have a progression which goes downhill. You can have a development which is for the worst. You can have an evolution which actually is bad news, can't you? But the connotation of each of those words is to something greater and greater and greater. And of course, the 19th century Western man thought he was the greatest and he was the last thing that had arrived, and so therefore the whole of history was heading to a great high point, wasn't it? And 20th century man doesn't mind thinking himself being greater than the 19th century man, and therefore still likes the idea that history is starting from nowhere and arriving at me. Chapter 3 says time's not like that. Time is oscillating. It's like a pendulum. There's a time for this and a time for that. A time for this, a time for that. That it's not going anywhere. It's not like the yo-yo, which is oscillating but heading upwards. It's much like the pendulum, which is actually just swinging from one thing to another. And that's the great poem that you see there, which the Seekers made popular in a popular song some 20 years ago now, for those of you old enough to remember, and those who've ever had a guitar lesson and therefore have been forced to sing it. It's a time for this, a time for that. Philosophy of time. Now, why is he saying it like that? Well, he says, this is the point. Not all days are the same. Not all occasions are identical. Not all times are the same. The days do not drag on identical with each other. Some are time for sowing, some for reaping, some for tearing, some for repairing, some for kissing, and some for refraining from kissing. Thus, there are fitting moments. There is what we would call good timing. There is the appropriate action for the occasion. There's the right time for the actions. Another time would not be the right time for the actions. Indeed, it might be the time for the opposite action. But life is not a meaningless succession of events. That's not the character of life. How can it be true that we get nowhere and do nothing? Because here is meaning, he says. Here is purpose. Here is value. Here is reason. We say that's a good time for it. It's the right time to do something. That is, in chapters 1 and 2, he spelled out how meaningless and futile life is. It's going nowhere. It's producing nothing. In chapter 3, he says, no, hang on, just remember, that's not right. Because there is a time for something. And another time is the time for the exact opposite. And so, therefore, there is some meaning to the events of life. Because if I took this second event and put it into the wrong time, it wouldn't be right. It'd be a bad thing to do. It's only good in its own time. So verse 10, you see, verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time. At the right time it's beautiful, at another time it's ugly. And so by saying there's such a thing as good timing, I'm saying there is such a thing as meaning and purpose and value. But yet, as verse 9 puts it out, what gain is there? For these great moments are like oscillations of a pendulum. Each one undoes the previous one. And therefore, you actually never get anywhere. I sow, only to reap. Life is not only kissing, it's also refraining from kissing. It's both. It's not just love, it's also hate. To describe life as a meaningless succession of events is inadequate because there's such a thing as good timing. But yet to find profit in them, to think that we're going to get somewhere, is inadequate because they all add up to nothing, because the good timing one time is the bad timing another time. The one event can be right and wrong, depending on the timing. And so he sees time hedges us into a terrible captivity, a terrible tyranny. This is the time, friends, for listening. This is the time for thinking, because it's around verse 10, 9, 10, 11 that the whole chapter turns, the whole point of the argument is caught up. God has made everything beautiful in their time. The beauty has to do with the timing. Sowing, reaping, scattering, gathering. See, if you reap at the wrong time, you will not get the harvest. You reap at the wrong time, you'll find the farmer will come out and shoot you. Reaping is right at the right time. You'll get paid to do it if you're at the right time. You won't get any help if you do it at the wrong time. So with sowing. So with scattering. For those who are Scottish amongst us, any Scottish people here today? I've got another nursery rhyme that I'd love you to explain to me later. Cut thistles in May. They grow in a day. Cut thistles in June. That's too soon. Cut them in July. Then they will die. I don't understand Robbie Burns either. The timing of what you do agriculturally is crucial. It's the right time to... It's all part of it, the beauty of everything, of each activity. Look at the verse 8, very funny ones there. Time to love, time to hate. You think any time's a time to love. No time's a time to hate. That's not true, there's a time to hate. There's a time for war, there's a time for peace. I think that the Second World War, fought by the Allied forces against Hitler and fascism, was a very timely war. I think it was the time to fight. It was the time. Now, you may disagree with me about that. There are not many fascists left, but some of them are still here, possibly. Those of us who have any love of humanity, any love of the Jewish people, would have to see that there was a time to bring them to a stop. It was a time... Not for peace, that is what Neville Chamberlain wanted, peace in our time, but it was not the time for peace. That was an awful mistake, it was only making it worse and worse. It was a time for war. Not many times I can think of I'd want to say it's a time for war, but that's one that was the time for war. But now, to invade Germany would be an appalling thing, wouldn't it? Now, to hate every German you met would be quite inappropriate. Now is not the time for war. Now is not the time for conquest. Now is not the time for that kind of hatred. Now is the time for peace and to make as much peace as we can with the enemies of yesterday. There is a time for something. What makes the action right has got to do with the timing. What is this about? This sense of time, this sense of propriety, this sense of rightness, this sense of the untimely and the inappropriate. What's it about? Verse 10 and 11 says that what it is that God has burdened us with this sense, with this instinct, with this idea of eternity. That's what it's about. He has made everything beautiful in its time and also set eternity into the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. This feeling of eternity says that there's more to the tedium of day after day. We see there is a time for the right thing. We perceive, therefore, that there's more to life than just the actions. You don't value life just by what someone is doing. It's got to do with when they're doing it. It means that you can judge the actions. There is a point of reference somewhere, but the point of reference can't be the actions because on another day, on another occasion, the very same action would be wrong. So it's not the action itself that gives value. It's something outside the actions that gives value. There is eternity in our judgments. The day is not just day after day, that my thinking is not just my brain twitching in some form of epiphenomenalism, that there is more to life than just living, than just doing. We perceive there is eternity. But yet, while we see there is eternity, we cannot work it out. We cannot see the beginning from the end, verse 11. We cannot see the way out. It's like being in a maze. It's like being lost. I was lost out at Sussex Inlet one time with my family in the car late in the afternoon and early evening in a forest of being clearly planted by the Forestry Commission, and you had all these marvellous dirt roads that crisscrossed each other everywhere, but no signs up to tell me where to go. And so each time I came to an intersection, I was faced with three or four different dirt tracks, and I would take a different one, and I'd head down that, and about half a kilometre down the track, I'd hit another intersection with three or four more dirt roads. Everywhere I looked around, all the trees were planted nice and neat in rows, and some of them being thinned out. You could see they were planted at the same time and everything else. It was all perfectly orderly. It's just no one had given me a map. I mean, I was stupid enough to go in there without one, wasn't I? But it was bewildering. I spent several, I don't know how it was certainly more than an hour, I would have thought several hours, as it got darker and darker with no points of reference by which I could work out the meaning of the forest. But the forest had a meaning. The roads had been laid out. The forest had been laid out. There was a meaning, but I could only get the meaning from outside, from the Forestry Commission, if they'd given me a map before I went in. And I couldn't get out there to find out what the meaning was, so let's take every first road on our left. Well, that didn't work because we wound up going around and around the same little, but you couldn't even tell that we were, so we'd take the first one on the left this time, the second one on the left the next time, third one on the left. We tried all kinds of random patterns. It made no difference. We couldn't find out. It's like the Hampton Court maze. You know the Hampton Court maze, that hedge, maze of hedges that's just outside Hampton Court Palace? It's great fun to go in there too, spend your money. And as you go in, there's a little kind of gateway, a little kind of pathway of hedges. Taller than you are, unless you're an extraordinary character, taller than you are, so that you can't see over them, you can't see under them. They completely screen your sight. They're about 3 feet wide or something like that. You walk 30 or 40 metres down to the edge of the hedges, and there you're faced with a T-intersection. You look to your right, and there is a little laneway of hedges heading off to another hedge. And you look to your left, a little row of hedges heading off to another hedge. Take your choice. When you get down there, you know what you're going to find, don't you? A T-intersection with another little row of hedges. And it's what you do to rats in psychology. Only we do it to humans over in Hampton. That's something about the English. And so once you're inside there, you've got nothing that you, no point of reference to find your way out. You know the thing is meaningful. The very way it's laid out indicates to you that it's meaningful. You know that it's not random. You know there is some trick to it. There is some key to it. But as long as you're in there, you can't find what the key is like. That's what he's saying time is like. Time indicates to us, the way we see that things are timely, the way we make our moral judgments and values, indicates to us there is a rhyme, there is a reason, there is a meaning to it all, but we don't know what the meaning is. We know the meaning is from outside, because when you're in the Hampton Court Palace maze, you look up, you can see the top of the palace with those incredible Tudor chimneys that they've got on the top of the palace. You can see that's where it is. In fact, you can cheat a little bit by keeping that on your left-hand side and keep on getting some bearing as to where you are because of that. That is, but you've got to have the point of bearing from outside the maze. You can't from within the maze. From within the maze, there's no point of bearing. It's been constructed to make sure there isn't. That's what life is like. That's what God has done. And so what can you do when you're in that context? Well, the answer is enjoy it. That's all you can do. That's the answer you're given in verse 12, 13, you see. I know there's nothing better for man to be than happy, to do the good while they live. Everyone may eat and drink, find satisfaction in his toil. That's the gift of God. There's nothing else you can do but enjoy it while you're there. Look at the hedges, see how beautifully they've been clipped, check the kind of fragrance that comes from the leaves when you give them a little rub, chat to the other people who are equally lost, make fun of them and make fun of yourself as you're doing, admire the precision of all the work and be thankful for the opportunity for a bit of walk, a bit of exercise. In fact, stay lost longer, you get more exercise, you know, and you see the beauty. Enjoy it while you're, because there's, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. I mean, you may as well enjoy the walk. It's like poor old, what's his name, Norman, Greg Norman. I can't understand how he can enjoy his golf. There's no enjoyment in his golf, and he certainly never gets his money's worth, does he? You know, 50, 60 shots and he's finished. Oh, I go for hundreds. All he does is see the centre of every fairway. I see fairways to my right, fairways to my left, roughs, dams, bunkers. I've seen parts of a course that he has never imagined were there. He gets no enjoyment from the activity because he's also goal-directed. I meet people coming the other way. Often. Once you're lost in the maze, once you can't get out of it, once you know there's no way out, well, what's there to do? Well, enjoy yourself. What else is there to do? There's nothing but to enjoy the trivia of the life. And such enjoyment is in work is from God as the best we can hope for here under the sun. Eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Yet the indications of the eternal show us that there is something more than time and trivia, that God's actions and our life is more meaningful than all this. And so that is the tyranny of it. The idea of the timeliness of something is very liberating, because I can say, aha, there is meaning. But it's very dreadful, because it keeps on saying, but you don't know what the meaning is. It places a great burden on us, a greater burden than ignorance, really. And God has done this. We're told in verse 10 and verse 14 that God has placed this burden on us for a reason. That is to revere him. Pick up verse 14. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing taken from it. God does it so that men will revere him. That is, it's like this so that we will stop looking to ourselves to find the answers and start looking to that which is outside to find the answers. As long as you keep orienting yourself to yourself, you'll never find the answer, because you are what is lost in the maze. The only way you'll find your way out is to look outside, to revere the one who has made the maze, and to look for his answer to how it's all laid out, rather than making up your own answer. The burden is to lead us to God. And yet, when we do look to this world and to eternity, we just keep finding it's horrible. For we say, okay, there is a right, there is a wrong, there is a true, there is an untrue. And so we look for justice, and what will we see? That justice is perverted. In this lifetime, it never works. So verse 16, I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. There was a piece of graffiti down at Central Railway some years ago, which is an old saying, but it was beautifully publicised down there, that the New South Wales police is the best that money can buy. Now, yet, when we do look to this world and to eternity, we just keep finding it's horrible. For we say, okay, there is a right, there is a wrong, there is a true, there is an untrue. And so we look for justice, and what will we see? That justice is perverted. In this lifetime, it never works. So verse 16, I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. There was a piece of graffiti down at Central Railway some years ago, which is an old saying, but it was beautifully publicised down there, that the New South Wales police is the best that money can buy. Now, I think that the recent inquiry in Queensland has held that in some question. I think there may be better ones that you could buy at other times. But there's something dreadful about a world in which the judges and the police and the justice and the magistrates are corrupt, isn't it? When those who make the laws and uphold the laws and administer the laws are actually having to be put on trial and put away in prison, etc. Where is the justice in this world? More of that comes in the coming weeks. And the answer is there's no justice in this world. We've got to wait for God and his justice. He is the one who times justice. He will, in verse 15, call the past to account. And so he thought in verse 17, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, and there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed, that this injustice of the present world is temporary. There will, in the end, be a testing of men by God, God's time for judgment. And the righteous and the wicked will be called to account. But then he thinks about it in verse 18 and he says, but as God tests men, you see that they're all like the animals. For the end point, the end test, is death. And in death there's no distinction between the righteous and the wicked. In fact, there's no distinction between the human and the animal. They are all the same. Death comes to one, death comes to the other. The animal breathes, the animal dies. The human breathes, the human dies. Where's the difference? Verse 19. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is meaningless. All go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all return. And who knows if the spirit of the man rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down to the earth. We are just no different to the beasts. And if we're no different to the beasts, then indeed it is meaningless, because they know nothing of the meaning of time. The beasts don't analyse whether that's a timely thing to do or an untimely thing to do. They just act. As we who are concerned about the times, the movements, the occasions, the rightness, the propriety, the justice, but if in the end justice is that there's no difference between us and the animals, well, There's no justice. There never was any. It's all meaningless after all. But then again, maybe there's life after death. Maybe death issues in the time when the righteous will be saved and the wicked will be punished, where the distinction between animals and humans... But he says, but hang on, how do you know? How do you know, verse 20, that it's not that the... Verse 21, it's not that the animals... You see, the animals may go up and we may go down. How do you know? After all, maybe the animals are better suited for heaven than we are. Animals don't make atomic warfare, do they? I mean, animals may kill each other, some of them anyway, but they don't do it for sport like we do. They don't do it for some kind of ideals like we do. They don't do it for greed like we do. They don't do it. They do it just for survival. We do it on a mass scale out of envy, jealousy, rivalry, out of racism, out of... We do it. Maybe it's the animals who are fit for heaven and we are not. Is that what it is? That God is eternal, but we are not? And that the animals will be brought into that eternity and we won't? That is, we know that eternity exists but won't have it. They don't know it exists but will. It's all meaningless. What can we do, he says, verse 22, but enjoy life? There's nothing left for it, is there? Eat, drink, work, enjoy this trivia, this common task, this daily round. Is that all that... If I'm no different to the animals, I may as well act like an animal. Why not? There's a famous student song which is sung in Latin, Gaudiamus Igitur. Traditional old European student song. You know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know that one? I always sing it as da-di-da because I don't know Latin. And I always sing it just straight on B-flat all the time. All right. I found a translation for it. It's lovely, really. Let us live then and be glad while young life before us. After youthful pastimes had, after old age hard and sad, earth will slumber o'er us. It's Ecclesiastes 3. While you're young, while you're alive, while you've got energy, while you've got youth on your side, go for it as much as you can, because you're just about to get old and then you're going to die and you'll be buried and there's nothing left. You've only got a few years to be young and to be happy and to enjoy life while you've got them to the hilt. Because when you get old, it's hard and it's sad and you won't be able to enjoy it. And after old age, there's the grave. See, the non-Christian understands quite clearly the meaningless and futility of life. And because we cannot see beyond the judgment of death, we can't make any meaning out of life. Even though we know by the way in which we say, oh, that was the right thing to do and that was the right time to do it, we're saying it has got a meaning. We don't know what the meaning is. Because nobody has seen beyond this judgment of death, no one knows what it means. For who has ever risen back from the tomb? Who has ever risen to tell us the situation? Oh, that somebody outside the forest could come and give me a map and say, that's the way. Oh, that someone outside the maze could come and signal to me that this is the way. They could come into the maze and say, look, I'll show you the way out. I've been in here before. I've got out. I know the way out. Let me show you the way. If only someone could come into the world from the other side and show me what it is that it's about. I know it's about something, but it requires someone to rise from the dead to make God's judgments clear, that I may truly enjoy life here, that I can be set free from the tyranny of knowing there's a meaning, but not knowing what the meaning is. Only if someone could rise from the dead. Well, my friends, it is the season called Easter. Let's pray. We thank and praise you, Father, that we are not left in a meaningless and stupid world and that we can see that there is meaning around us.
We pray that you would help us to accept the burden that you have placed upon us, that we might look to you to find the meaning rather than to wallow in our own meaninglessness. We thank you that you sent your Son from outside of this world into the world to live with us here, to die with us here, and to rise again to show us what it's all about. We do pray that you would help us to be sufficiently humble to ask for help. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.